From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is Please Explain.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Sony Pictures, presenting All the King's Men. Sean Penn leads a cast including Sir Anthony Hopkins. All the King's Men is in theaters September 22nd.
As our oceans are increasingly being overfished, many wild fish populations are dropping. And as a result, more and more of the world's seafood supply is coming from farmed fish. So we're devoting today's Please Explain segment to aquaculture. With me now are two fish farmers, Dr. Bob Valenti of Multi Aquaculture Systems in Amagansett, Long Island, and Josh Goldman, President and U.S. Executive Director of Australis Aquaculture in Massachusetts. And joining me in studio is Dr. Becky Goldberg, a senior scientist with Environmental Defense, and I'm very pleased to welcome them all to my show. By the way, in a little while, we will be taking your calls at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Let's go to you, Dr. Valenti, and you, Mr. Goldman. Do you prefer to call it fish farming or aquaculture?
Certainly doesn't make any difference to me. I mean, aquaculture is sort of a broader term that involves things like shellfish and other than just finfish. And fish farming is pretty much just finfish. So
aquaculture can be shrimp and lobster and all the rest
exactly,
of that stuff.
Exactly.
Do you know approximately what percentage of the fish eaten in America today comes from fish farms, Becky?
I would say somewhere in the neighborhood of like 20%.
So I would have imagined more, judging from what I'm seeing in my local stores.
Yeah, I actually think it's much higher. The United Nations just put out a new report on aquaculture worldwide, and close to half the fish consumed by humans worldwide is now from fish farms. In the United States, most of the salmon, much of the shrimp, all of the catfish, much of the shellfish we consume is now farmed. So while there's no exact figure available, it's probably close to half of what people eat in the United States.
Josh Goldman, can you describe what your fish farm looks like? What kind of facilities do you have there?
Australis operates the largest indoor fish farm in the United States, and it's if you drove by from the outside, you would see something that looked very much like a conventional manufacturing facility. Inside, there are a series of very large tanks and filtration systems that allow us to recreate the fish's natural habitat, which is something quite unique.
In this case, it's only a fish called barramundi.
That's right. This is a fish native to Australia's northern tropics, which is now newly available in the United States as a farmed product.
And Bob, you raise a wide range of fish, so that must require a different sort of operation than Josh's.
Well, ours is what is called a semi-open system. We're constantly flushing local water in and out of our facility, and we raise a series of marine fish, finfish.
Such as?
Fluke, blackfish, sea bass, and even winter flounder.
And so those are all saltwater fish. Could you just as easily be raising freshwater fish?
No. We have no access to freshwater, and our access on the eastern tip of Long Island is clean seawater.
And why those fish? Are they easier to raise than some others?
To some extent, and it's also based on the dollar value of a product. I mean, certain fish would not warrant the effort, and some fish, such as sea bass and fluke, in the Asian markets have very high values, and that's predominantly why we work with them.
Which ones aren't worth it?
Well, it's not that they're not, but financially rewarding would be things like bunker or menhaden or fish that, herring, butterfish, fish that are not more in volume and not necessarily is in high demand.
Josh, are barramundi in demand? They're rare in the United States, aren't they?
Barramundi are quite rare. They've really only been in the market for the last couple of years.
Where would you catch them in the wild?
you would catch them in the northern portions of Australia.
So you have to go to Australia to get fish to stock your farm?
We do. We actually bring them in from Australia, although in the last 6 months we've brought broodstock over so that we can have a closed life cycle, as we call it, reproduction, all the way through here in the United States.
Do they start just generating their own, or do you have to keep on going to Australia to get more?
One always has to mind the gene pool, and so we will continually go back to Australia to keep an effective breeding population that's large enough. But fish tend to be very fecund. One female barramundi can produce 1 million eggs at a go, and so you don't need a whole lot of moms and dads to run an operation.
And do they travel well? I'm sure that you're flying them from Australia.
It's a long journey, and it does entail some challenges, but we're bringing over typically 250,000 fish every 4 to 6 weeks at this point.
When you put them in the salt water, is salt water salt water? Or do they would they see a difference between what you have and what the waters in Australia, around Australia, would be like?
Well, the barramundi are fairly unique, and we selected them because they have a lot of advantages in terms of some of the sustainability issues that I'm sure we'll be talking about. And this is a fish that starts life in seawater and then often stays in seawater, but it also goes into freshwater. It goes up into the billabongs, and so it's quite adaptable to different environments.
My guests on today's Please Explain segment are Josh Goldman, President and U.S. Executive Director of Australis Aquaculture in Massachusetts, Dr. Bob Valenti of Multi Aquaculture Systems in Amagansett, Long Island, and Dr. Becky Goldberg, who's not related to Josh Goldman in any way, except that they both have gold in their names. She's a senior scientist with Environmental Defense. And this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What do you feed farm fish? Do they eat pretty much the same things that they would eat in the wild? Bob,
well,
how about you?
It depends at what stage. When they first start out as larval fish, they're fed a live diet of usually rotifers, which is a planktonic organism, small planktonic organism.
And would they eat that in the wild?
They would eat rotifers along with other planktonic material, which they could get, but depends the particular area that they would be hatched in terms of the wild situation.
And then later?
Later, in a hatchery, you usually swing fish to a Artemia diet, which is brine shrimp, which probably a lot of people are familiar with from tropical fish culture. And after that, they put on a diet of either ground fish or a pelletized feed. And pelletized feeds are usually preferred because you're not dealing with as much bulk in terms of weight because it's dehydrated.
Josh, do you do pretty much the same thing with your barramundi?
We do. We have a hatchery that has the live feed process, as Bob described, and then the fish are transferred to a dry pellet as they wean and continue on a dry pellet through their life cycle.
Becky, what farm fish eat is one of the controversies of aquaculture, isn't it?
Absolutely. Aquaculture is often promoted as an alternative to fishing, as a way perhaps even to lessen pressure on overexploited wild fisheries. But in fact, some types of aquaculture, such as farming of salmon, for example, rely on feeding large quantities of fish meal and fish oil made from wild-caught fish to the farm fish. And the result is actually a net loss of fish in the process of fish farming. For example, on average worldwide, it takes something on the order of 3 pounds of wild-caught fish to produce 1 pound of farm salmon. And while smaller, low-value fish are being caught to grow bigger, higher-value fish, ecologically, it's not a way to deal with the problems of overexploitation of our oceans.
Is that a concern of yours, Bob?
No. Actually, I would disagree on a few points. Number one, everybody always blames overfishing as the cause of the decline of many of the inshore stocks of fish. And that is not always being able to be verified because there are fish such as winter flounder that I'm quite familiar with here that have totally disappeared, and a lot of the disappearance is not based on anybody catching winter flounder. They're a fecund fish that can produce millions of eggs per fish, but it might be more akin to a habitat loss, and the habitat is due to so many homes that are built on the shorelines and run off from septic waste that go into the sand and things of that nature. And as just one quick point, the bunker or menhaden fishery that used to supply fish meal and fish oils was very much popular in the United States in the, let's say, up to the 1950s. And then because of pollution controls, we did away with most of our fish meal factories, and now most of the fish meal comes from Latin American countries down south that have filled the void. Instead of menhaden, they fill it with anchovies, and these are fish that are extremely abundant, and that's why they can be rendered into fish meal. And if you will, maybe the fish meal should be on the diet of humans instead of on the diet of fish. I wouldn't disagree with that at all, but it has always been the case that animal feeds use fish meal because they are high in protein, relatively inexpensive to use, and they also don't bind well as products to make for human beings, and that is one reason we don't sit down to a bowl of fish meal instead of high-priced fish.
Josh, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think if we take the broad view and look at the tremendous growth of aquaculture that has and is continuing to take place, there is a real concern about where is all the feedstock for farmed fish going to come? And clearly this industry cannot continue with its high level of reliance on fish meal if it's going to continue to grow at the levels that we're seeing today.
What about the health of... Well, first of all, let me give out the phone number again. If you would like to call us, it's 212-433-9692. Aren't medications put into these fish farms, Becky?
Some fish farms use medications such as antibiotics in fish diets. It varies a fair amount by aquaculture sector and where fish are being raised. Much of our fish comes from abroad. Most people think when they go to the seafood counter that they're getting something that was caught maybe in an adjacent state. But in fact, 80% of the seafood we eat is imported.
Farmed as well as wild?
Yes.
We're starting to see a lot of fish farming in China and other places?
Absolutely. I mean, most of the farmed salmon and farmed shrimp we eat, for example, which are two of the top three seafood choices in the United States, come from abroad. And in many developing countries, restrictions on use of compounds like antibiotics in feed are pretty loose.
So what do they do in many of these places? Just put some kind of a pen out in the ocean a few miles out and then stock it with fish?
Well, it varies by what's being grown. In the case of salmon farming, a lot of the salmon we eat come from Chile, and there fish are grown in what are called net pens. That's just what they sound like, nets or cages placed directly in the ocean, not generally a few miles out, but relatively close to shore because that makes the pens easier to service. In the case,
but wouldn't that also mean the salmon can't swim very much? Isn't part of being a salmon that you swim great distances?
They're certainly limited in how far they can swim because the salmon are in a pen. Not a tiny pen, but it's definitely a pen. Other types of fish, though, are raised in very different ways. For example, shrimp farming is typically done in ponds. Most of it comes from Asia and Latin America. The ponds are often along the coastline and pump in seawater to grow the shrimp.
I read that in 2003, California banned raising salmon in state ocean waters. Why was that?
My understanding is that California banned raising salmon because of concerns about the impacts of escaped farm salmon on wild fish populations in California, particularly endangered runs of native salmon.
Now, Bob, I've heard that you released some flounder recently on purpose. What was that all about?
Well, the town of East Hampton, the trustees, paid us to spawn not only winter flounder but northern blowfish, both which the stocks are extremely low and have been low for almost 10 years in the case of flounder, in the case of blowfish since the 50s. And we would spawn wild fish that were brought in from fishermen and rear the offspring to a juvenile size, approximately 2 months of age, and then release them back into the wild. But unfortunately, the DEC of New York State felt that this was not something they wanted to have happen because they didn't think there would be any benefit for releasing winter flounder. In this case, it was 70,000 juveniles.
But the idea is similar to raising eagles and then putting them out in the wild, or wolves or whatever.
Exactly. They're not hatchery. They're hatchery reared for 2 months of their life. They go through a, in the case of the winter flounder, it's a, when it's first hatched, it's extremely tiny, and it essentially swims like a normal fish. And then after 30-some-odd days, it goes through a process of metamorphosing to where its eyes are on one side and its mouth flattens out. And all of that is a tremendous strain. And in the wild, you become susceptible to being gobbled up. So in a hatchery, you can protect that group of fish and do a much better job. And releasing juveniles is not foreign to a lot of what a lot of countries do.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation and take your calls at 212-433-9692. My guests are Dr. Bob Valenti of Multi-Aquaculture Systems in Amagansett, Long Island, Josh Goldman, President and U.S. Executive Director of Australis Aquaculture in Massachusetts, and Dr. Becky Goldberg, Senior Scientist with Environmental Defense. Stay with us. And we're back with Dr. Becky Goldberg, who's a senior scientist with Environmental Defense, with Josh Goldman, president and U.S. executive director of Australis Aquaculture in Massachusetts. He raises barramundi, and Dr. Bob Valenti of Multi-Aquaculture Systems in Amagansett, Long Island, who raises a wide range of fish, fluke, flounder, and others. And we are taking your calls on today's Please Explain at 212-433-9692. Sharon from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to know what was the difference between coho salmon and farm-raised Atlantic salmon. I was told the coho was wild. I was wondering if there was a nutritional difference and also why the wild salmon was cheaper.
The wild salmon is cheaper.
That's what it was in my supermarket.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Neither none of these people raise salmon. Now, is that...
I think I
can address it.
Okay, well, you first, Becky, and then you, Bob?
Sure. Farm salmon around the world are typically Atlantic salmon. That's the species that's most cultivated, although there is a small amount of coho salmon that is farm-raised in Chile.
Most people prefer Pacific salmon for its taste?
Well, most of us never get to taste wild Atlantic salmon because actually wild Atlantic salmon are in the endangered species list, so they don't appear on menus. But many people prefer the taste of wild salmon to the taste of farmed. Wild salmon tends to just be a little bit more flavorful due to, you know, whatever the farming practices are. In response to your other questions, Sharon, there are some nutritional differences between typical farmed and wild salmon. There are some studies now that show that farmed salmon can have significantly high levels of contaminants, such as PCBs. On the other hand, farmed salmon tend to have pretty high levels of omega-3 fatty acids. The levels of these omega-3s, which people regard now as really heart healthy, vary among Pacific salmon species, with king salmon having quite high levels, and pink and chum salmon, relatively low levels. Coho are somewhere in the middle.
But also, don't the salmon farmers add dye to make the salmon look pink the way wild salmon looks?
Yes. Wild salmon eat a lot of krill and other creatures that give them a natural pink appearance, as farm salmon don't get that from their prepared diet. So colorant is added to the diet to make the salmon a pink or orange. You can actually get something that's like a series of paint chips if you're a salmon farmer to choose what color you want your salmon to be. It's called a SAMO fan. If you want a lot more information on salmon, I suggest you look at websites on Seafood Choices. We have one called oceansalive.org. The Monterey Bay Aquarium in California's website also has a great deal of information on different species of salmon.
Now, Bob, you wanted to add to that?
Well, I think salmon farmers get a bad rap because initially wild salmon was extremely expensive from Alaska or the West Coast to the East Coast. And if it weren't for farm salmon coming from Chile first and now frequently from Maine, the prices of salmon dropped drastically, and it's only been in recent times that the price has gone back up because of the bad name that farm salmon has gotten from feeding. The color issue is an interesting one.
Well, why can't they just feed the farm salmon krill?
Well, you can feed it carotenoid pigments, which is what krill has. You can extract that pigment, add it to the pelletized feed, but that was a major cost in the feed of salmon. So what was done was they came up with a simulated material, which was a chemistry set to do away with the artificial, with the natural carotenoid pigments. And if you will, if you could eat a salmon that is not fed any carotenoids and not fed any krill or shrimp, in which case it would be white and it would taste just the same as if it were, you know, a red salmon.
Yeah, it's like putting yellow into margarine.
Exactly, exactly. It's what the consumer demanded. I remember years ago, Dome Sea Farms raised Atlantic salmon or coho salmon, pan-sized coho salmon, and in Oregon, and they were selling them, and there wasn't a tremendous liking for the bland white-colored flesh because they didn't use a carotenoid diet at that time.
Let's put Margaret from Queens on the air. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Oh, hi, Leonard. Yeah, I wanted to ask about, we heard, I think it was a year or two ago, about contamination in the seabeds and what they were, you know, feeding them and all this sort of stuff, that the waste wasn't getting out and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. I would like to ask the doctor about that.
Okay. There are a lot of environmental problems that are associated with certain types of salmon, of fish farming. Some types of fish farming have relatively few environmental impacts. For example, we recommend among good choices for consumers a catfish, farmed caviar, farmed clams, farmed arctic char, farmed mussels, and a variety of other
tilapia,
types of fish.
Tilapia, I understand, is usually pretty good, too, farmed?
Well, no? Tilapia farming is highly variable in how it's done. Tilapia raised in the U.S. are a great choice. Some of the farming in Asia is not as good. On the other hand, farming of salmon and shrimp has been tremendously controversial. As you point out, Margaret, one of the impacts people have been concerned about is the discharge of huge amounts of fish waste. It's just like having animals on a feedlot. If you have some animals in a pasture, the waste is dispersed. But when you put a whole bunch in one place, you can cause problems. And we've seen that with salmon farms and shrimp farms and some other types of aquaculture, too.
Now, Josh, you raise your barramundi in a building. They're not out in the ocean. So what do you do with the waste?
We're able to collect all of the waste and store it seasonally and then land apply it onto local agricultural fields. So it ends up being beneficially reused as a fertilizer.
But that would be impossible if you were out in the ocean. And that is a concern for a lot of people. We have a call now from Annie from Westchester. She's a farmer. What are your concerns, Annie?
Hello?
Yes, Annie.
Hi. Well, you just touched on a little bit the effluent in land operations, what happens to it.
Well, would you use it as a fertilizer?
I heard that, Josh, just a moment ago. And so you are able to use all of your effluent for fertilizer and you're not over-nitrogenizing the fields?
No. In fact, we ask the farmers to sign an agreement with us committing to sustainable practices, which basically just requires that they till it in so that the nitrogen is indeed captured, doesn't run off the fields, and then by using correct application rates, the vast majority of those nutrients end up benefiting the soil in the field crops.
So soil testing is done on a regular basis, and you know that you're not putting too... We know what happens with the pig farming. And I wondered if there were soil tests that followed up and all that sort of thing.
Well, one of the real benefits of aquaculture, and particularly if you can control the environment and choose the right species, is that you can get very efficient feed conversions. Many of us read Diet for a Small Planet and were shocked to learn that typical beef production requires 20 or more pounds of feed input. We're able to grow our fish with well under 1 pound of feed going in for each pound of fish we produced. And the result of that also comes through the waste stream. So there's very little waste that's actually generated. We have a farm that's producing close to 1,000 tons a year, and all of the waste products can be dealt with on approximately 40 acres of nearby farmland.
Thank you so much. Is this integrated fish farming? Because I've heard that it's more environmentally sensitive than other methods of aquaculture. Can you explain what integrated fish farming is?
Well, when people talk about integrated farming, they usually mean farming more than one species at a time. And in the case of fish farming, what's often done is to grow along with some sort of fin fish, also to grow seaweeds or mussels or some other sort of shellfish that actually filter nutrients out of the water so that the fin fish who produce waste fertilize the shellfish and the seaweeds that take it up. And those sorts of systems can be very environmentally sound. What Josh is doing or what some other farmers do is use fish waste to grow plants, to grow crops, and that's also a form of integrated farming. That generally only works, though, when you're raising fish in fresh water. If you're growing fish on salt water, obviously you don't want to apply the fish waste to cropland.
Bob and Josh, you both have fairly advanced technical backgrounds. What drew you to fish farming? Begin with you, Bob, and then you, Josh.
What brought me to fish farming?
Yeah. Is it just you just fell into it, or something that clicked when you were in college?
Actually, it was something that clicked long before college that made me interested in finfish in general, and culturing them was something that I seemed to be good at. And I left research because that almost got to be... that was my breadwinning situation, is to do... aquaculture research for many years, but you were forever trying to adapt to a new situation and to where funds were available, and it just seemed appropriate to go into fish farming and do something that was real, and that's what I did. And I sort of look back on it and think, could have been a mistake. I would have been probably retired from a university by now, but I guess I enjoy what I do, and that's why I do it.
Well, Josh, what brought you to Barramundi?
Well, for me, it was really looking at the whole resource problem. And when I got my start in the early 80s, you know, overfishing was really becoming an issue in the U.S., and so there were people, I was one of them, that saw aquaculture as quite possibly the solution to this overfishing problem. And I've endeavored to pursue a course that is mindful of these resource issues and to select species and technologies that really are advancing the cause of what we need aquaculture to do in a resource-constrained world.
What do barramundi taste like?
They're similar. They're a sea bass, and I would say they're comparable to a grouper or a snapper. They're very moist, delicate, succulent fish.
Do these fish get transported to markets live, or are they put on ice on the farm and then shipped?
Principally, they're sold on ice, and you would find them in fine restaurants and grocery stores, but they also appeal to the Asians and are sold live.
And Bob, you ever send any of your fish live to stores? Because if you...
Frequently, yes.
In Chinatown, for example, we see an awful lot of fish in tanks.
Yes.
I wonder how many of them are farm-raised and how many of them are wild.
I would say the majority are probably wild fish in Chinatown and the Asian markets. But there's a fair amount of the sale of live fish. They're caught live, kept live, and then distributed live.
Do you people ever get tired of eating fish?
Not me.
I have an email from a listener who wanted to address the matter of menhaden as a source of fish meal. He says menhaden are indeed unpalatable to humans, and so are a source of protein for pet foods. However, they are a small fish which travels in large, relatively easy to spot schools over the continental fish are being fished near to extinction as a result. They are ecologically important species, especially as prey for others, more desirable species, at least from a human consumption perspective. So he says there's no free lunch, as it were, in ecological terms. And this may not be the best solution either.
Well, I don't think menhaden is still being overfished in the United States. It's a fast-growing organism, and it's a planktonic feeder. It eats plankton. So it's a herbivore, if you will.
Yeah. And there's actually a lot of controversy about to what degree menhaden should be fished in the United States, particularly on the Atlantic coast. Most people would agree that menhaden populations are not plummeting, but on the other hand, menhaden are really important in the food chain for other larger commercially important fish and other sorts of wildlife. And our fisheries management doesn't take that into consideration, and the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Council has recently put a cap on the menhaden catch because they want to take a better look at the effects of fishing for menhaden. That's really important to the health of our East Coast oceans.
And just one more thing, Becky, before we go. A listener wants to know why some fish are labeled organic. Aren't all fish organic?
That's a really good question. There are some imported farmed fish that are now being certified as organic by private European certification agencies that have set their own standards. There are no standards in the United States at the moment for organic fish farming. I'm actually on a task force of the U.S. Department of Agriculture that's now working on drafting some standards, but it's probably going to be a couple years till we have any sort of meaningful label in the U.S. marketplace for organic fish.
And we have to leave it there. I want to thank you all for participating in Please Explain today. Dr. Becky Goldberg, a senior scientist with Environmental Defense, Dr. Bob Valenti of Multi-Aquaculture Systems in Amagansett, Long Island, and Josh Goldman, President and U.S. Executive Director of Australis Aquaculture in Massachusetts. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, a former ghostwriter for Billy Graham, Jerry Falwell, and Pat Robertson talks about what he calls the hidden dangers of fundamentalism. And then we'll take a look at the history of chess. Also, a man who's been living with HIV since age 11 when he was infected by tainted blood. Plus, the former Baghdad bureau chief for the Washington Post shares his perspective on life inside the Green Zone. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenda Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Chris Bannon is the executive producer. We had help today from Barbara Kahn and Jennifer Keeney-Sendro. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host, and I'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.